fasten your seatbelt, and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we take the interstate off-ramp, and we head off the beaten path down a winding dirt road into the deep woods of northern Wisconsin, where we see a rough-hewn log cabin, a cabin without electricity or running water. And inside, we hear the sounds of an acoustic guitar and violin, playing old world and new world folk music. And for a few minutes, the 21st and 20th centuries peel away, and we're back in a simpler time when civilization wasn't quite so civilized. This is the home in the world of Paul and Susanna Gilk, a home without a computer and even a telephone answering machine, in which Paul writes his books and his newspaper column and lives what he calls a life of voluntary poverty. Today we welcome Paul and Susanna to our 21st century airwaves on Wisconsin Public Radio as they share their music and stories, and he talks about his latest book, a collection of philosophical and political essays titled Green Politics is Utopian. Now, as always, we'll be taking your calls and questions live on the air. The numbers toll-free are 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you're calling from the Wausau area, 261-6371. That's 261-6371. Paul and Susanna, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you very much.
And you live a life of voluntary poverty, Paul. What's that like?
Well, first, I think it's necessary to say that voluntary poverty, U.S. style, is probably a whole different kettle of fish than poverty in poor countries. So that what I would call voluntary poverty is not really all that impoverished at all.
But it is relative to the consumer society that we live in.
Yes, we live on less than $10,000 a year and have done so for many years.
And you live in a log home. Tell us about that.
I lived first, beginning in 1976, by building a little cabin with total carpentry incompetence, but did it anyway, and then proceeded to live in it for most of 20 years. And then that building was beginning kind of to fall apart, quite frankly, and I decided it was time for a different house, and found an abandoned 19th century hand-hewn log house between Merrill and Tomahawk that had been originally constructed, I presume, by immigrants from Sweden. Or at least it was in the Swedish tradition. It was full dovetail corners, and its last usage was as a dump for household trash, and the usage prior to that was as a barn, so it had about 6 inches of horse manure in it.
So you had a bit of work to do.
Yes.
And no electricity in the home?
No, well, I had to disassemble this entire building and move it. So that's what I did, with some help.
And the home right now, it's in the Merrill area? Is that where you lived? I know you grew up there.
Right. It's northwest of Merrill by about 12 miles in the town of Harding. And it's the log house now stands on what was a portion of the small farm that I grew up on.
And there's no electricity, no running water. How do you get through the long, dark, cold winter in Wisconsin?
Oh, I don't know, like everybody else, I guess. We get up in the morning and go to bed at night. But we have a wood-burning cook stove and the equivalent of a Franklin stove with a glass window in it. It's a fuel-efficient stove. And so we watch fire and we read and our light in the dark of winter in the evenings comes by kerosene lamps and candles.
And Susanna, you've bought into all of this. You could be living the life of luxury in a penthouse in New York City somewhere, and here you are living in the woods north of Merrill in a log home without electricity, without running water. What's with that?
Well, I don't know if that was a choice, the penthouse in New York City. Nobody offered it to me. But over the years, I really have come to love this lifestyle and see the value in it, beauty.
You grew up in Switzerland, correct?
Yes, yes.
And what brought you over here?
I met a man in an international work camp in Switzerland. fell in love and immigrated to the United States.
And what year was that?
69.
1969. Mm. When did the two of you meet?
Somewhere about 83, 84.
Now, did you always have a desire to live a rustic lifestyle, or is this something Paul kind of talked you into?
Or maybe some of it evolved. Yeah, some of it. I grew up in the city in Switzerland, but my parents had a little farmhouse in the mountains, and I spent a lot of my childhood there and loved it very much.
How difficult, Paul, is it for you to pursue your chosen career as a writer without a computer or a word processor or email to respond to readers or even an answering machine to record incoming calls when you're not at home? That personally has frustrated me, I might mention. There have been a couple of times I've tried to call you, and I've realized after a certain point in time that I just had to be lucky and get you when you happen to be near a telephone.
Well, I don't know. You could ask this question of Henry David Thoreau or any number of other persons who didn't even have that option of having a computer or a word processor or a telephone, or much less a telephone with an answering machine on it. You know, I don't understand why it should be a disability not to have those things.
Do you ever eat fast food?
Oh, once in a great while, but I can't say that I like it very much.
Do you drink soda?
Very rarely.
Do you use cutters or mosquito spray? Now, that's the most important question I'm going to ask
Almost never.
Really?
Yes.
Never. He does never.
How are you surviving in this particular spring and summer with the amount of water we've had? And I know I walk out of my house, and I live south of Maryland, and they're just, it's like a cloud of mosquitoes that descends from the sky on you.
Well, we've sent them your way, you know, that's part of it. To reference Thoreau again, I guess, lots of things that people perceive as needs really are not exactly needs.
You grew up in Merrill?
I grew up on this small farm outside of Merrill.
But you graduated from Merrill High School?
Yes, I did.
What year was that?
1964.
And what were you like then? Were you following this trajectory that would lead to your current life, or were you going down a more traditional path toward, say, a typical American consumer lifestyle at that time?
Well, I would say that I was in a state of involuntary confusion, in the sense that I had grown up on this very small farm, and it's a farm my father primarily made by himself from what had been no farm at all, no buildings, no cleared land. And he had begun that process around 1930, 1929, 30, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up on a very tiny homestead farm with lots of subsistence practices still operative, but increasingly being thinned out or weeded out as mechanization came in after the Second World War. I was born in 1946. So by the time I went to high school, like any other boy, I would have been embarrassed to death to have gone to gym class in the locker room, to have put on my gym clothes and be found to be wearing long johns, for instance, in the winter. I mean,
yeah.
You know. So I was being shaped by mass social consensus into a kind of mass consumer person, in a way.
And rural people in America, and kids can be very brutal in the way they refer to one another. Rural people are derided, they're insulted, they're called hicks, they're called rednecks, hillbillies, what have you. It says something about the way we treat farmers and treat real rural people in this country, that maybe all of our values aren't where they should be.
Well, I think the anti-rural bias, I mean, you're leaping into a very large and difficult area of discussion that is terribly complex. But I think there is a huge anti-rural bias, not only in this country, but probably worldwide, wherever civilization has taken hold in a hegemonic way,
mm-hmm.
Rural values are squeezed and demeaned.
But it's got to affect you as a kid growing up. going to high school.
Oh, yes.
Do you still stay in touch with any of your old friends from high school? Do you still run into them in Merrill?
A few, yeah. Not many. High school really, frankly, doesn't mean that much to me, and I look back on it now as being, in some ways, an incredible waste of time.
And the two of you are active in the peace movement right now in the Merrill area. And at first glance, Merrill wouldn't seem like a place that would have an active peace movement, but indeed it does. Tell us about some of the people that you brought into the area and some of the conversations that you have on a regular basis.
Well, I think it was 2002 in January when Irene Milos and the chaplain at that time from Good Samaritan, they started a peace study group, and this is still existing, and we try to meet every Wednesday, which is probably quite a bit, so sometimes we are just gabbing, but we also try to do different things, and when the death penalty vote came up, we were working on that, mm-hmm. anti-death penalty. We tried to get speakers. Whatever it is right now, we are trying to get a peace scholarship going.
But you've got a handful of people.
Very small.
But some with religious backgrounds that are,
yeah,
are,
some
are working
not,
in that direction.
And some are. But there is also quite a bit of a wider circle that we can ask for help at times when we do something special. One of them is the Quaker group, and the other one are, for instance, the Holy Cross Sisters that happen to be in Merrill, which is wonderful, or WASA peace mm-hmm. groups, Antigo, a new one now, and Pax Christi group up in Managua.
And Paul, you've been writing, and you've taken your own philosophical perspective about America, about our consumer culture, and it's in this new book, Green Politics is Utopian. Now, you spell utopian with an E-U instead of the common U-T-O-P-I-A-N. What's the difference?
I learned of this distinction through the late American historian Lewis Mumford, who wrote from roughly 1922 till about 1970.
He was a friend of Frank Lloyd Wright's, wasn't he?
Probably. I'm not that familiar with his friendships, but that's conceivable. They would have been contemporaries, at least for a big hunk of their lives. And the first book that Mumford published is called The Story of Utopias. That came out in 1922. And the distinction Mumford builds in that book, it has to do with this e-utopian construct. And what Mumford says is that the word utopia, as we normally use it with a U, was coined by Sir Thomas More, who was a contemporary of Henry VIII in England, and who wrote a kind of a fanciful story and called it a utopia, a word he coined. Mm-hmm. But utopia with the U, our common word, was for Sir Thomas More what Mumford calls a mock term or a middle term. And on either side of the word utopia, one term was outopia, and the other term was utopia with an E in front.
Now, and what's the difference?
Well, the outopia would be something that would be idealistic and technological and kind of something that springs out of the rational mind, some kind of fanciful structure, whereas utopia with an E in front, the E-utopian, is something that is ethical and ecological. So that, therefore, green politics, which is, of course, about ecology and about ethics, is in this E-utopian tradition, originated as a term, at least, by Sir Thomas More.
Now, you write about permanence as a goal of utopian thinking with a U, whereas e-utopian thinking with an EU embraces the impermanence of nature. There seems to be a struggle between permanence and impermanence mm-hmm. in those two terms.
Yes, right. I think that's correct.
And the permanence is sort of an offshoot of civilization as we know it, correct?
Well, Yes.
At least it's a goal of civilization.
At least it's a goal of civilization. I mean, even as America now imagines itself, or its current leaders do, that America is the only superpower in the world and will remain so for the foreseeable future, it's a kind of projection of American power permanence on into the future without end.
The idea is that human beings can reach perfection through their technology, through their civilization, through their rational dominance of nature. As I understand your writing and Mumford's, and that perhaps what we ought to be doing is trying to live in harmony with nature.
Well, I think what we're beginning to see, since at least the rise of the ecology movement, though one could say, you know, the First World War, the Second World War, Auschwitz, and Hiroshima proved that the perfectionist utopian thrust of civilization is in fact unsustainable. And throw into this mix now the proliferation of nuclear weaponry. This becomes a cliche and a truism, but in fact those weapons are out there, and they're out there right now. In fact, Secretary Gates just fired people from the Air Force because the Air Force flew some armed nuclear weapons.
Right
over the United States, right. So we tend not to think about these things very much. We tend not to think that they could actually be used when, in fact, they're ready to be used at any moment. And if they are used, life as we know it is over. It's over.
Now, Paul, there seems to be a deep skepticism about civilization in your work, and you question whether civilization as it's currently defined is even a good thing.
Well, let me say that I grew up with the very conventional understanding that civilization is an unqualified good. Somehow, and don't ask me how, but I absorbed that point of view as I think virtually every other school child in America absorbs it. And this idea began to suffer some cracks in it when in my early 20s, I was living then in the city of St. Louis, and discovered I was missing farming, missing the rural life. And I knew that small farms were dying, or at least being hammered. And so I found the smartest people I could find, and I asked them, why is this the case? Why are small farms dying? And they gave me various answers, none of which satisfied. They just didn't seem to resonate. And so I thought, well, I have to begin somehow to explore this question in a way in which I can arrive at an answer. And so one of the people I turned to was the historian Lewis Mumford, who is a world historian in the sense that his analysis begins way, way, way back in time in hunting and gathering periods, mm-hmm. and so on, and builds his analysis of how we've come to the modern world. And so it was there that I really began to discover the origins of agriculture, and consequently, in discovering the origins of agriculture, discover the origins of civilization and its relationship to agriculture.
I want to pursue that more in the second half of our show, but right now I'd like the two of you to pull out your instruments. We'll play a little music, and then we'll take a news break. And we'll be back right after this short break with Paul and Susanna Gilk. Paul has a new book, and there are a couple of folk musicians. We'll be listening to their music on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600. Thank you.
the music and words of Paul and Susanna Gilk on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'll be back with much more after this short break for news.
Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Rutabaga, the paddle sport shop, sharing the experience of serenity found on Wisconsin lakes and rivers. Instruction for all ages and abilities with test paddling every day. 220 West Broadway in Monona or on the web at rutabaga.com.
We're back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guests today, Paul and Susanna Gilk, who live lives of voluntary poverty, and Paul, who writes interesting books, books which are travelogues in one sense. He wrote a travelogue about a trip back to Switzerland, which is his wife Susanna's native country, and a new book on green politics called Green Politics is Utopian. It's published by a company out of Eugene, Oregon called WIPF, and Paul, help me out here.
WIPF and Stock.
And if I'm not mistaken, you can order it online at whipandstock.com. And Paul, I understand they're also bringing back an earlier one of your works that's out of print right now.
That's correct.
And tell us about that book that's in the hopper, so to speak.
In 1986, a small press in southeastern Minnesota, Anvil, which really was the, kind of the sidearm of a small regional quarterly called North Country Anvil, published this book as both as a special issue of the magazine, that is in 1986, as well as a magazine-sized paperback. And so now WIPF and Stock, it's now out of print, and WIPF and Stock has shown an interest in reprinting it. So I'm in the process of doing some slight revisions and make it more a little up-to-date.
How did you get hooked up with this publisher in Eugene, Oregon?
Well, Mike Miles, who lives over in Luck, Wisconsin.
Mike ran for Congress on the Green Party ticket.
That's right.
A couple of years ago.
That's right. And Mike is lives in the Anathoth community, which is a Catholic worker farm. So he's part of the Catholic worker network. And I've known him now for probably close to 10 years and consider him a friend. And a year ago this past winter, out of some sense of desperation, I sent him a copy of Green Politics is Utopian and said, I can't figure out how to get this thing published. Do you have any ideas? And it turned out he had a friend at WIPF and Stock who consented to look at the manuscript, and so here we are.
And again, that that email address, because the book is just out, and I'm not sure if you go into any of your local bookstores, they'll have it at this point in time. But it's orders at whipfandstock.com. That's spelled W-I-P-F and stock, S-T-O-C-K. You wrote an earlier book on a six-week trip that you took back to Switzerland, Paul. It's called The Moon is Always Male, and this was
in Switzerland, the moon is always male.
Right, in Switzerland, the moon is always mm-hmm. male, and it's a six-week return to mm-hmm. Susanna's homeland of Switzerland. Susanna, you actually built your violin in Switzerland, that beautiful
That's
instrument
true.
That we were listening to before the news break. Tell us about that.
Well, I come from a family of musicians, and I decided as a teenager to become a violin maker. And so I entered the Swiss Violin Maker School and was there for 4 years, which is the length of the apprenticeship. And this was my last piece that I could take home. And so I have
So this was
violin.
Kind of a school project. And you obviously did a nice job because it sounds like notes coming out of the wings of an angel, you know,
the
beautiful tone of that instrument. Is this something that kids are taught commonly in Switzerland? We don't normally think of children in America learning how to make musical instruments as part of the curriculum.
No, this is not common. This is the profession I chose.
Okay.
I am,
okay.
I was a violin maker. Yeah.
And how is violin making going in Switzerland right now? Is that kind of handicraft, those kinds of skills that are passed on from generation to generation, is that a tradition that's continuing strong, or is some of it falling by the wayside?
There is families and sons that take it up and take a violin shop over that still exists. And there is in every large city in Switzerland, there is several violin shops because there's way more orchestras and way more music in a small area than here in the United States. Now I go to Duluth. They have my bow rehaired,
mm-hmm.
Which is very far.
Because you have to drive that far, and in Switzerland you'd be
10
able to
minutes,
find it.
Yes, I will find a violin maker.
You write in the book, Paul, about seeing violins being mass-produced by machine.
Well, no, I didn't see them, but Susanna went to a violin maker's school in this little town called Brienz, which is not that far from Interlaken. And we got off the train, and there are trains and or buses everywhere in Switzerland, so you don't need a car. We got off the train in this little town, and we began walking toward the violin maker's school. And Susanna said, "Well, let's go see the guy who made my bow, because bow making is a separate profession."
Mm-hmm.
So we did. And I asked him something then about how it was going, violin making and bow making, and he was kind of grumpy about it. And he said, "Well, the Chinese are chipping them out by the dozens. You know, they have very sophisticated machines that are computer driven, and they can rough out a violin or a bow in a very short time. So they are kind of undermining the economic viability of the handcraft side." But so, I actually didn't see this. This is secondhand.
So the globalization that's affecting the economy here in America, it's also affecting old world countries like Switzerland.
Apparently so, yes.
2616371, 2616371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Paul and Susanna Gilk. And we will be listening to some more music in just a couple of minutes here. Susanna, you are dedicated to working for peace. Do you think you've been influenced by your childhood in a country that somehow managed to avoid participating in wars for over a century?
Well, I don't know if you know, but Switzerland also has a military. But
do you want to see my Swiss Army knife?
Well, those come in handy, and you can use them for peaceful purposes. I think I come from a family. I have a grandfather, had a grandfather, who I would say he was a pacifist. I have a cousin and an uncle that refused military service in Switzerland. My father didn't have to serve because he had an ear problem, which he was very happy about. So those kind of discussions, I kind of grew up with those kind of discussions.
If you look at the map, Switzerland is surrounded by Germany, Austria, France, Italy, and tiny Liechtenstein. It's kind of an oasis of calm among neighbors who have often been at odds and taking up arms against each other. And I'm wondering if growing up in that area, if in a sense there's more of a sense of completion, of living in a land that's been settled for centuries, where relationships have been worked out, and maybe there isn't a driving sense like we have in America that everything is constantly changing and you always have to be abreast of the latest and newest trends.
Well, this brings to mind the first time I met Susanna's parents. They had come to America, and we were not yet married. And, you know, I'm struggling to make conversation with them because they don't speak or didn't speak English, and I don't speak German. And so through Susanna, I asked Susanna's mother if there were kings and queens in Switzerland, you know, being the normal dumb person. And she indignantly said to me, again, through Susanna, well, I want you to know that Switzerland has been a democracy since 1291.
Really?
That's when the first cantons got together. That's the beginning of Switzerland, 1291.
Are Swiss people as obsessed with consumerism and the latest trends as those of us in America seem to be?
I think in a little different way. I think they're not so much a throwaway society than America is. For one thing, the quality of things are much, much better. And so you have something that you buy for a long time because it's lasting and it's beautiful. Now, this is all generalizations, of course. But, you know, it's a wealthy country and people are well off. And I have two sisters. One is actually in Germany, but the other one is in Switzerland. And they can afford a lot of nice things also and love them.
But the things last. And,
they last.
And they aren't
more.
Being constantly replaced.
Right. And I remember my mother coming to a Thanksgiving dinner in Milwaukee and couldn't believe that people were using paper plates on a feast day.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Jim in the town of Maine. Jim, you're on Route 51 with Paul and Susanna. Hello, Jim.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
And I'm wondering, Paul and Susanna, what you would suggest to the average American that is involved in a life of consumerism, how to get started in a more simple life. Would you have any specific suggestions for cutting out what is unnecessary?
I'll try to answer or at least make a comment to that. I always try to explain to people, especially in Switzerland too, is neither Paul nor I do work full time. And we do a lot of things that we love to do and work pretty hard on it. One of them is Paul's writing, the music, and we do a lot of gardening. And those are all things that basically cost us nothing. But we also make very little money because we don't work for money a whole lot. But the quality of our lives is amazingly wonderful compared to people that go to the factory and work all day. And I guess that's my comment.
Jim, did she answer your question?
Oh, okay, sure. So the answer revolves around the idea that having a lot of possessions doesn't really lead to a more satisfying life.
Not necessarily, not at all. Okay. Especially when you have to start protecting your possessions and can't even enjoy them, like we see so often.
There comes a time when you have too many things to take care of.
That's
too
right.
Many items for the wife to dust. Okay, thanks.
Jim, thanks so much for the phone call. 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg. We're talking to Paul and Susanna Gilk. Paul's got a new book out on Green Politics is Utopian. It's been published by Whip and Stock Publishers, and their website is whipandstock.com. We'll be back with more of the guitar music of Paul Gilk and the violin music of Susanna Gilk right after this. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. We have Paul and Susanna Gilk with us, and they are going to play some more music for you. Paul on his Mexican guitar?
A Korean guitar.
A Korean guitar. And Susanna on a Swiss guitar, which she made with her own hands when she was studying to be a violin maker in Switzerland. So we really have an international show here today. What are we going to hear from you now?
This is an Appalachian tune called Home with the Girls in the Morning.
Paul and Susanna Gilk. Wonderful. And another selection?
Yeah, another Irish tune called Rights of Man.
Back in the 1800s, or maybe even at the turn of the last century, or for much of the first part of the past century, that's how people entertained themselves. We didn't have television. Radio transmission was spotty. People played music for each other, or they played cards, or they had conversations. Mm-hmm. Is this something we're in danger of losing in America?
Well, I suppose the short answer is yes, or not even so much in danger of losing, is that we largely have lost it already. Television, radio, and so on, computers, all of this has undermined these kinds of local folk arts, folk crafts.
Yeah, there's a strong religious thread that runs through your writing. The reach for permanence in civilization and perfection is described by you as an attempt to eat the apple of the tree of knowledge, or to assume the role of gods in our own dominion over nature. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, you know, in the Genesis story, when Eve and Adam are thrown out of Eden, if you read the narrative carefully, you'll see that they were only incidentally thrown out of Eden for eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that the other reason given for their being evicted from the Garden of Eden was that they might eat of the tree of life and live forever. What we are seeing, I think, with the rise of such an intense technological civilization is in fact we now have that capacity through genetic engineering to begin to tamper with that tree of life, as well as with weaponry. I mean, nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, all this kind of stuff, the depleted uranium that's been used in Iraq, all of this stuff has an impact on what metaphorically we would call the tree of life.
How do you respond to people who would say that your philosophy is un-American because America is all about capitalism, free markets, consumerism, and the right to go out and become wealthy?
Well, I would say that that's not all America has ever stood for. I don't think one could argue that that hasn't been a huge thread, more than the thread, maybe a bulldozer trail in American history. And certainly the current condition of American life would bear that out. But it's not the only thing that's been operative. Even the Jeffersonian vision of a nation of small farms. I mean, Jefferson wanted a nation of small farms, after all, because he felt that if people could not live independently, they would be incapable of independent judgment. And if they were incapable of independent judgment, we would end up with a tyranny. And I think we have a very subtle kind of tyranny. We have a tyranny of technological political consumerism.
You're obviously going against the grain here. can we ever become again a nation of small farms and agrarian values?
I think the answer is yes, but the process whereby we get there is going to be very, very difficult. I mean, we have, in principle, the capacity to get there voluntarily and with a very minimum of suffering. The same way, for instance, we could address fossil fuel emissions and climate change and global warming by radically installing a massive mass transit system in this country that would be publicly owned. I mean, we could be taking our gas tax money and building state and national railroads. But we're not doing that, and we're not doing that because socialism is, a big boogeyman in this country, and number two, the corporations apparently are determined to hold on to their profit margins until things literally fall apart.
You think it's possible for us to do it? Do you think we will do it?
I think we will either, well, the options that I've begun to consider, the options are either we will do this, either we will somehow voluntarily begin to move in this direction, and I think there is evidence to say that we are politically capable of doing this, despite what seems to be the case, or we are going to see the restoration of a pre-industrial aristocracy, which will reduce the mass of people to a kind of post-civilized destitution.
Paul and Susanna Gilk, interesting people leading interesting lives with interesting ideas that are definitely against the grain of contemporary American society, and they're living a life that is definitely in line with their ideas, proving that you can live a life of voluntary poverty. The book is called Green Politics is Utopian. It is on whipandstock.com if you want to place an order. And thank you, Paul and Susanna, for being with us today. Thanks to our on-air producer, Jane Ritger, our executive producer, Rick Ryer. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 and a theme, and a special thanks to Paul and Susanna for this afternoon's live music. Next week, Route 51 looks ahead to the annual Renewable Energy Fair in Custer, Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.